Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as the Church marks the feast of Corpus Christi, we hear about the charism and missionary activities of one congregation of women religious, the Adorers of the Blood of Christ. But first, we go over to the UN in Geneva, where the Holy See this week hosted a special event dedicated to the memory of Blessed John Paul II. The memory of the former Pope, Blessed John Paul II, and his huge contribution to the human rights movement was recalled at the United Nations in Geneva on June 20th during a special event hosted by the Holy See's permanent mission there. The event brought together church leaders, diplomats, members of human rights groups and others who work closely alongside the Holy See at the UN's Human Rights Council in Geneva. Just ahead of the event, I spoke with the head of the Holy See's mission there, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, who told me more about the background and the aims of this commemorative encounter.
The permanent mission of the Holy See, together with the permanent mission of the Republic of Poland, have joined forces, so to say, to recall and to point out the contribution that Blessed Pope John Paul II has made in the area of human rights. Here in Geneva, we have the third pillar of the United Nations organization, that is the Human Rights Council. And therefore, it seemed appropriate to look at the towering figure of John Paul II in terms of what he brought to this specific dimension of international life and social life, that is the respect of human rights and the application and implementation of these rights for the good of the people. And in this way, we came in agreement with a new Director General of the Office of the United Nations here in Geneva, Mr. Tokayev, and a group of people will speak in the form of a panel: the Cardinal Archbishop of Lyon, Cardinal Barbarin, a former Prime Minister of Poland and Ambassador to the EU, to the Holy See, Madame Sukoska, and the Ambassador of Israel to the Holy See, because John Paul II had opened a special relationship and changed the mentality of looking at the whole church relations with the Jewish community. And there will be also some other interesting activities, like something that I consider a bit original: the exhibition of all the stamps published by the different countries of the world, hundreds of stamps. And this exhibition will also show in a figurative and interesting new way the tremendous impact that the figure of John Paul II had on the world. And then there is another important motivation for this initiative: the openness to the world community. This globe-trotted Pope is in line with the mission of the United Nations, that is the forum where all the countries of the world talk, fight, try to solve their problems. And John Paul visited both the United Nations in Geneva and in New York to give a signal that the Church is ready to help in solving human problems by bringing as a contribution its long experience in humanity, or as an expert in humanity, and the value and the wisdom of its centuries-old experience on one side, and on the other, the doctrine, the priority that given to the human person, the respect of the cultures of all people, and so forth. So I think from the response that we have, the hundreds of people who will participate, that this message is still alive and meaningful.
And yet the relationship between the Holy See and the United Nations has not always been an easy one. If you think particularly of issues around women's rights or family and gender issues, do you think this event will have an impact on that relationship? Do you think it will help to stress the importance perhaps of working together rather than in conflict over some of these concerns?
At least this seems to be the message of the popes, both John Paul II, Pope Benedict XVI, and his visit to the UN in New York, for example, and his appreciation of the work being done by the organizations of the international community. Of course, there are some fundamental principles with which the Catholic tradition can find itself not in agreement with some of the decisions or some of the ideas that are present in the debates and in some of the documents of the United Nations. The Church remains committed and to defend and support its own convictions, not because they are kind of detached from reality, but because they are the real way to promote the good of the human person and of the community of nations. So like the defense of life, the fight against abortion, the respect of women and men and their identity as God has created them. These are fundamental points that are independent of one faith or another, but regard the human person as such and the human society as such. And that's because of the good of the person and society that we are promoting and defending and upholding these principles and such a reality. This said, there is a lot of goodwill and a lot of respect for the work of the Catholic Church, not only in the areas of health, charitable services, education, but because people are aware of the enormous contribution that the Church is making in the area of health education, in particular, in the area of service to elderly, to children. And notwithstanding some bad publicity, there is a lot of common sense and knowledge on the part of people who are involved in the international multilateral diplomacy. And so the question is, to what extent we can work together and to what extent we need to be separate in upholding our principles and our convictions and trying to communicate and share these convictions with others, because as we see them, these convictions are going beyond one religion, one organization, but serve the entire human family.
My thanks there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. To adore a person means to enter into a very special relationship with them. A relationship of total, unconditional love. A love that strives to serve and to imitate, to become one with that person. In a nutshell, that's the spirit with which the adorers of the blood of Christ approach their ministry and mission. The Adorers are a congregation of religious women who work in countries across the globe, bringing Christ's message of compassion and hope, of healing and hospitality, especially to those places where they see the greatest needs. Over almost two centuries, that's led to the foundation of schools, hospitals, care homes, social centres and outreach projects in rural Africa, Asia or Latin America, as well as in poor neighbourhoods of cities across Europe and the United States. With a mother house in the small town of Acuto, just southeast of Rome, the congregation has opted for the first time to hold its general chapter in India, where vibrant communities of sisters have been growing for the past three decades. From July 7th to 31st, the sisters are gathering in Mysore, south of Bangalore, to reflect on the theme Choose, Then Life, and to forge a vision for the congregation over the next 6 years. I sat down with two of their general counsellors, Sister Therese Wetta from the US and Sister Mary Kuti Kanatu from India, to find out more.
I'm Sister Therese Wetta. I am an adore from the United States and serve on our general counsel.
I am Sister Mary Kuti. I am coming from India. I too am an adorer of the blood of Christ. And at the moment, I am working in Rome as a general counselor.
Tell us, first of all, something about the history of this congregation, its origins.
The Adores were founded in Italy in the mountain city of Acuto by a woman named Maria de Matias, who 8 years ago was canonized, so is now a woman for the whole church, not just for us. Maria was born in Valle Corsa, and during the time she was young, a Precious Blood priest came to preach a mission talking about how much Jesus loves everyone and shed his blood, and she was very touched by this. This became the seed that bore fruit in our congregation.
So it started in Italy, but now, today, you have people all over the world, don't you?
Yes. In fact, we have our sisters in all the continents. We are around 1,510 members. And recently, one of our foundation became a region, that is Tanzania, with around 70 members. And we are working, the main ministry, the main apostolate that we do is education and healing ministry, lot of parish activities, I mean the pastoral ministries. And in all these, our activities, we give more lot of importance to women and children because our founders, Maria de Matias, she was giving lot of attention to women. During that time in the 18th century, women were considered as nothing, not respecting the value of women that time. No, so she was with a revolutionary thought, no? I mean, a prophetic vision she had to respond to this.
Something of a pioneer within the church in
yes.
her day.
Yeah.
She was. Her motivation was that each person is worth the blood of Christ and should know this great gift, but she also had this intention of going where the need is greatest. She always said, go where the need is greatest. So this is part of also what I think has prompted us to go to many parts of the world.
From the name Adorers of the Blood of Christ, it would sound as though you're a more contemplative order, and yet that's not true at all, is it? You're a very hands-on, as you say, trying to go where the needs are of the poorest.
Yes. Maria, I think, is such a model for us because she was able to integrate the contemplative life and the active life. And in our constitutions, we say that to be an adorer or to be in adoration means that we grow in our love relationship with God, but that it isn't our full-time, and in a way it is our full-time goal, but we do it through ministry and working with others and also our community life.
Maria de Matias was, she was passionately in love with Jesus crucified. And she was often sitting before Jesus crucified and she was contemplating Jesus crucified. Especially her thought was, her attention was focused on Jesus giving all his blood for the humanity to give life, to give reconciliation, to give fullness of life. That means Jesus came so that we may have life, life in fullness. This she reflected, she contemplated, and she tried to imitate that love of Jesus, to transmit this compassion of God, and to become slowly that living image of that charity. In other words, a living icon of compassion.
You also have some sisters, don't you, who have, in a sense, imitated that sacrifice and given their own lives, haven't they?
We do. In 1991, in fact, the letter the General Superior wrote in our chapter documents talked about that we were calling ourselves to give all, even to the point of shedding blood. And 18 months later, we had 5 sisters killed in the civil war in Liberia. They were missionaries from the United States who got caught in the dynamics of the Civil War. And so little did we know that call or that reminder was going to be reality for us very soon afterwards.
They died serving the people there, remaining despite the war that was raging around them.
They were called home to the States, but all five of them felt strongly in their hearts that they wanted to be back with the people, and they requested that the leadership send them back. The leaders at that time said, you must talk with your families, make sure they know the danger you're going into. We honor your desire, we have reservations, but you may go. And they went back to be with the people, and they suffered the same consequences that many of their people did.
Did you know them personally?
I knew some of them personally, yes.
What kind of legacy do you think they've left to the congregation?
In our congregation, we call them the Martyrs of Charity. And I think the legacy they have left for us is that the reminder that we must all be willing to walk the talk, to live what we say, and if that means giving ourselves to the point of shedding blood, we place ourselves in that openness. And I think that they also have left a legacy of compassion and trying to bring reconciliation. We express our charism today in those two words, and they went back to try to help be a reconciliatory presence, which unfortunately did not work at the time.
But have there been other sisters who have gone to take their places there?
For some time, the leadership in the United States was not open to this. Actually, now we have one sister back in Liberia for a 3-year commitment, and we have recently received an invitation from leadership in the United States to reconsider serving in Liberia. So we may be back there in stronger force, which would be another honoring of their legacy.
You talked about education, women and children particularly, as part of the charism, part of the particular focus of the congregation. Tell us a bit about that work that goes on today, particularly, for example, in India.
Okay. First of all, I would like to say that we started this our mission in India in 1978. Actually, the seed was sown. The seed of this mission was sown when 8 young women from India, they came to Italy and they took their formation here, and they returned back to India in 1978. And in 1980, we started our mission actually there. Then from the very beginning, we started with a school, then social centers to respond to this need to give dignity of women especially. And right now we have 3 schools and the 4th one is coming up. And we also have social centers, 3. And
Where are these, in the cities or in the rural?
In the villages, in the rural villages of 8 states in India, especially in the southern part of India. Now, recently, since 3-4 years, we also moved towards north. Anyway, more missionary activities are being done in the part of northern part of India because the Christianity is more stronger.
I would just like to add, having been to India 2 times, like our school in Bangalore has over 1,000 students. These are huge schools that accept all students of all faiths, but are value-based and very strong schools. Big commitment on the part of our sisters there in this ministry.
As you say, they're not all Christian children in the schools by any means, so it's a form of dialogue as well, isn't it?
Yes. It's a form of dialogue because it is interfaith. The children and teachers from all the faiths are there, especially more Hindus because about 83% of Indians are Hindus and a small percentage is also Muslims. But we Christians are 2.5%.
Now, you're holding your first general chapter, or rather, for the first time, you're holding your general chapter in India, aren't you?
Yes.
Why this decision?
It's actually our first time going outside of Italy, so this is very historic for us.
And what sparked this decision?
Part of what sparked it is that in our last general chapter, we called ourselves to walk new ways and create new paths. And as we considered where to go, it seemed the time was right to also apply this about General Chapter and to go to a new place. The last General Chapter also called us to be very much more conscious of discernment as a habit, and the Eastern spirituality very much lends itself to discernment and contemplation. It's a growing area of our congregation. We have, I think, now 79 with the recently professed 79 members in India. We also, because we call ourselves to work with the poor and with women and children who are striving for more rights, we looked at Latin America and Asia as our possibilities and then chose India. We also wanted to go where we felt we could make a statement about women and children and experience another culture where women don't enjoy the same freedom of movement and rights that many of us do in the countries from which we come.
So what are your hopes for this General Chapter? You'll be looking forward to drawing up some kind of new vision, won't you, for the next few years? What do you think will come out of it? What are your hopes?
First of all, the theme of the assembly is Choose Life. Therefore, as women, we are called to choose life, being compassionate, and also trying to see how we can promote life, how we can choose life within the congregation, for the church, for the world. So we are also trying to be aware of, consciously aware of what are the challenges that is there in our world today, the world that is profoundly broken many ways. And also it has positive, but there are so many, lot of brokenness. So also with regard to religious life, what are its challenges and how we can choose life for us. Also in choosing our ministry and living our mission, always choosing life.
You're talking about the challenges facing women and girls in India particularly. There are so many difficult issues, aren't there, from infanticide, from the desire for male children rather than girl children. Tell us a little bit about perhaps your work in some of these very challenging areas.
Yes, especially in the rural areas, in the village areas, because of the lack of education. Because of the ignorance and lack of education, and this goes on, especially when the girl child is born in a family in the rural areas, it is difficult for them because soon they think about the dowry that they have to give to the girl child. And also being a girl child from the very beginning, she has to suffer because attitude of submissiveness. That means a girl, being a girl, she has to obey the parents. When she is older, she has to obey her husband. And in her old age also, no? As in all the stages of her life, she has to live a submissive life and also hard work. And also she has to be more responsible. And the family thinks that still in the rural areas, they think that the women are called to give birth to the children and also to bring them up and also to do the household work alone. But now it is slowly changing. Now we see that also from the rural areas, a lot of development is taking place in the rural areas, so much so that so many young girls are also going to study and they are also working and also they are equally earning members of the family and they feel more rightful position in the society. So, I mean, with the husband, she is equal member like that. It's coming up. Also now the man started sharing in the responsibilities of women in the household work. Earlier it was not. He was thinking he is the great person in the family. She has to do everything. And dowry deaths are very often, it is happening still. It was happening more earlier, now it is little less.
What do you see as the keys to changing these very ancient attitudes, these ingrained attitudes of, as you say, women being very subservient and the man being in charge?
Giving awareness. No, to the women, we are, for example, what we are doing also, we have in the social centers, different organizations and groups where the awareness is given and the people come from outside, we call the experts, they give awareness classes and all conscientize them about their dignity and right in the society. We also enable them and to
make a living.
Yeah,
because they teach them They teach them practical skills for the household and raising family, but also things like sewing, computer, textiles, so that they can then, and it's like microeconomic project. So they teach them additionally how to take the money they earn and put it in a bank account in their name, so that if something happens, they have a financial resource to fall back on. I've really been impressed with what our sisters are doing in the in these social centers.
And in the villages, the girl child, she goes to the school, but very often she is forced to leave the school because maybe she has to take care of the young child, the young member already, you know, the newborn baby. Or she has to take care of the cattle or something like that. So she stops. So the religious, especially, they give a lot of attention to these girls. So these school dropouts, we give them special tuition classes, special coaching, so that we teach them. Then we enable them to go to school. So in this way, so many of the girl children, we help them to have education. We encourage them. Also, the government in the rural areas, in some states, now encouraging them, giving them bicycle, giving them some help to have books and things like that. So economically also helping. So
it's really a model. You're hoping that the example that is going on there in India perhaps will inspire other ideas as you look to the next 6 years.
Yes. One of the things that we have done in preparation for this General Assembly are two theological reflection processes with all our sisters around the world. And out of this, the last question for the theological reflection was, what radical next step? One, we ask from each community, do you believe the congregation needs to take? That, I believe, those responses are going to be the heart of this assembly. For instance, our Constitution says, and we talk about giving preferential option for the poor, as does the church. But what we have called ourselves to in the responses is to let ourselves be converted by the poor, not just to be with them and work, but to be more vulnerable ourselves and learning from them their great trust in the providence of God. We've called ourselves to simplify our lifestyles even more, and we've been working on this. We've also called ourselves to collaborate more with the church and with other organizations to work together to change the systems that keep people oppressed. And of course, underneath all of that means that we need to continue ourselves to be converted and to become more compassionate and more reconciling presences. We've also very much, and we've called ourselves to, actually an idea that came through from several of our places around the world is to establish one or two intercontinental local communities in a new place to be with some poor for whom we have not been a presence and begin a couple of new ministries. So that might happen too as a result.
Certainly a very challenging agenda. We look forward to hearing about it perhaps when you get back after the general chapter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sister Tree Sweater from the United States and Sister Mary Kuti Kanatu from India are general counselors for the Adorers of the Blood of Christ. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Thanks for listening, and do be sure to join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.